Quarreling. I picked out this verse about 3 months ago when we were looking at it and thought, that would be fairly easy. Don't quarrel. Actually, it's a really big subject. And I'd like to start off with a story that Luke tells in his gospel. Jesus is teaching to lots of people, and this guy comes up to Jesus and says, "Teacher," so full of respect, "tell my brother to share the inheritance with me." Fair enough. There's obviously a quarrel between this guy and his brother, right? I should have some of this money, and the brother, for some reason, isn't letting me have it. So, Jesus, will you sort this out? And Jesus says, "Who made me a judge or divider over you?" Well, excuse me, but aren't you the Messiah? I mean, you know, aren't you the ruler of the heavens, as we've been singing? Aren't you the creator? If you can't decide between us, who on earth can? But Jesus is saying, you're missing the point. Okay, and I thought it was lovely, your prayer just now, Jackie, that we look at the external stuff and think, if I could get my brother to give me that money, which I think is rightfully mine, then I would be a happy, fulfilled person. And Jesus is saying, no. And strangely, there isn't any more conversation about this. Jesus just says, who appointed me as a judge over you? And then it moves on to the next story. And I think it's important to recognize that Jesus is asking us to look inside when we look at externals, but we are going to be looking at quite a lot of externals this morning. There's a lot in the passage that Emma read. Thank you, Emma. And I don't propose to cover it all, otherwise we'll be here longer than the hour that I've already planned. So today I'm going to be focusing on the first part about conflict and quarreling. And while today the focus is on conflict, conflict in my mind is just one symptom. There are a number of symptoms of things that are rolled up in the same problem. So here we go. First thing to say, I don't think that we as a church are struggling with internal factions, divisions, conflicts, quarrels, and so on. I might be wrong. If I am, please tell me, but I haven't seen it. But James tells us to hold up a mirror. James's letter is written to a wide spread of Christians, and he highlights a number of things to start doing, to stop doing, and to continue doing. And he expects us to process and spot which is which. So he'll describe something, and we need to think, okay, does that apply to me? Look in the mirror, he says. Decide what to keep and what to change, and then having made your decision, do it. It's like a health checkup. The second thing I wanted to say is that we all know about quarreling. I think it's fair to say. We all do it. Is that fair? We have a difference of opinion with someone, which in itself is fine. We don't all agree on everything, but then it gets heated. Our emotions start to flare up and we start taking things personally. And they start maybe to reflect on our sense of identity or our self-worth. We start to get aggressive and attack the other person with our words. Or we go quiet and feel resentful. Does that sound familiar? But we tend to dismiss these things as, oh well, it's just one of those things. Arguments happen. Or, why is he or she being so unreasonable? Why don't they get what I'm saying? I think we tend to class our day-to-day conflicts as petty or trivial, which they may be. But James is saying that the reason why we do this is not trivial at all. It needs to be recognized and dealt with. So I'm going to spend some time looking first at non-trivial conflicts and what we as human beings are actually like. So let's have a look at conflict then. As you look around, as Andrew's already mentioned, you have to say that there's a lot of conflict going on, and I would say there is something fundamentally wrong with people. Just this week, we've got conflicts around, from the tragic to the seemingly trivial. Russia still fighting in Ukraine, conflicts and power struggles within our government, and disagreements about climate change, and even who should go to the meeting. But first, let's focus on conflict in the sense of actual battle, proper war, stuff we all recognize and see. So we're going to look at some facts from history, because it's sometimes easy, I think, to dismiss what we humans are really like. The German philosopher Hegel said, the only thing we learn from history is that we learn nothing from history. We often hear people say, well, yeah, but that was then. We're more civilized now than in the past, or that particular events were an exception. Most people aren't like that. We dismiss it, we talk it away. We miss the scale of it and the reality. So I hope that today we will be an exception to the general trend. We don't learn anything from history, and we'll look in the mirror at who we are. So let's take a scale, avoiding small fights, all right? Let's say if you take a war to mean a conflict where over 1,000 people have been killed in combat or as a result of combat in a single year, if that's what we mean by a war, more than 1,000 people in a year, how many wars do you think there are going on right now? Give me a number. 22. And that's where more than 1,000 people have died, either in 2021 or in 2022, and the war is still going on. Let's increase the scale. Supposing we said 10,000 people in 1 year, how many wars? No, not as many as that, fortunately. We've got six. But right now, there are six wars happening where in a single year more than 10,000 people have been killed. So if you do the numbers, I don't know what the total is, but we're probably looking at heading for 100,000 people in 1 year being killed in conflict. I don't know whether that surprises you. Shocked me. I think of England as a relatively peaceful country. Now, some of you who come from other countries may laugh at that, but hey, I'm English, so I'm allowed to say that. And I think that's kind of an idea we have of ourselves, that we're peaceable. So, a little bit of history. England, as such, was a nation for 780 years until the Kingdom of Great Britain was formed in 1708. 780 years. How many wars do you think England fought in? 780 years? 64 wars. That means, and that includes against Scotland, Wales, Ireland, and several civil wars, in other words, against ourselves. I mean, you know, if there's anybody there, we'll fight them. So in our first 780 years, we had a new war starting on average every 12 years. But to be fair, during that period, we were mostly limited to northwestern Europe. So we didn't actually have that many neighbours to fight. In the 17th century, we started serious exploration of other parts of the world. So, looking at Great Britain, between 1708 and 1913, I'll do the sums for you, 205 years, how many wars do you think we were involved in then? 205 years. Anybody want to guess? 113. So for those two centuries, that averages slightly more than one new conflict starting every 2 years. there is something fundamentally wrong with people. Okay, but we're more civilized now, aren't we? Things change. So since World War I began in 1914, so we've now got 108 years from then till now, how many wars do you think the UK's been involved in? 108 years. 54. So the news, guys, is that we are still averaging a new war once every 2 years. So I'll leave it to you to decide how much more civilized we are. The reality is that over the last 1,100 years that we as a country have existed, and I'm just talking about England and the UK now, we've been involved in 231 wars, and over the last three centuries, we've averaged a new one every 2 years. And this is just us. This doesn't take into account the countless wars between countries and communities across the world that we haven't been involved in. These are huge numbers, and this is just looking at the conflicts or quarrels at the level of one nation going to war with another. It doesn't pick up on the millions of lives that have been lost or the misery that's been caused. Over the summer, I was reading a fascinating book about some key figures in the Middle Ages in England and France. These rulers, kings, earls, and so on, were very wealthy because they owned vast amounts of land. They let the peasants farm the land in exchange for a percentage of the crops in tax. That was their income stream. And these rulers didn't have a permanent army. Most full-time experienced soldiers were independent professionals who hired out their services to anyone who needed them. That was their job. Nowadays, we'd call them mercenaries. So a king or an earl who wanted to fight an enemy needed to hire an army. And these armies needed to be paid, otherwise they'd stop fighting for you. So a ruler with no cash can't fight. Okay? Now, that means that a pretty usual tactic of the time was an economic one. You send in your cavalry to destroy all your enemy's crops. No crops, no taxes. Your enemy's got no income, no money, can't pay his army, and so he has to stop fighting you. Hooray! What about the peasants whose food for the winter you've just destroyed? What happens to them? Does anybody care? As long as we win the war, there is something fundamentally wrong with people. Well, yes, you say, but aren't many of these wars that we've been involved in the other people's fault? Thinking of Nazi Germany, Second World War, the Nazis were bad people. I'm not going to talk today about Nazi atrocities, partly because that period is very well known, partly because it's easy for us to say, well, it was an exception, and partly because it was them, not us, what did it. Or to put it another way, yes, there's something fundamentally wrong with people, but it's mostly other people. Nice idea, but it doesn't stand up to the facts. Take France, our nearest neighbours, one of our nearest neighbours. The longest war in our history was against the French. Anybody know how long it lasted? It's called the Hundred Years' War, but that's an exaggeration. It was 116 years. And in the last 900 years, how many wars do you think there have been specifically English fighting against French? 30. That means that on average, through the last 900 years, every English generation has been involved in a new war against the French. So would we say that all 30 wars are basically the fault of the French? Yes, because we're English, right? There is something fundamentally wrong with people, and specifically with the French. But actually, we have to recognize, don't we, that there's something fundamentally wrong with us too. We have to say that conflict that escalates to the level of war, with many thousands of people dying every year, is actually normal. It's what people are like. Generally, we avoid recognizing this because it's painful and it's hard to admit. And I'm not saying at all that it's okay or acceptable. James is very strong on the subject. But we need to recognize it as a problem that we're all involved in. It's what we're like. So there is a fundamental problem with people, but it's not limited to the French or the Germans or the anybody else as a nationality that's the problem. It's not limited to the rich or powerful. It's a problem that each individual, each of us, faces. Factions and quarrels between and within communities come from individuals. There's a wartime song, "Let's All Be Beastly to the Germans." I don't know whether any of you know or remember that. The Germans, the whole lot of them, 60 million people, whatever it is, they're the bad guys. Each of us, the reality is, can start a conflict. And if you have more power, more money, more influence, you can start a bigger conflict. But then there's the risk that we say that there's something fundamentally wrong with rich, powerful people. And again, we miss the point. It's about us. We all have a problem. Now, James doesn't ask in the passage we've read in the abstract what causes fights and quarrels as some sort of philosophical question. He's saying, what causes fights and quarrels among you, among us here? So this isn't about why was there a Second World War. Is it the fact that we're different? You know, differences between people. One of my favorite history books, which I find both interesting and very funny, goes through a whole series of historical events since 1066. Showing how the Brits and the French will look at the same historical event, but interpret it differently. We see the Battle of Agincourt as a fine example of our plucky English lads triumphing against the odds over the larger and better armed French army. Yes? The French see the same battle as another classic example of repeated acts of English betrayal and complete disregard for the well-established and honourable rules of battle, the Geneva Convention of their time. The English, they would say, simply can't be trusted. And there's often a sense of exasperation on both sides of how can they possibly think that? They're mad. The book, if anybody would like to borrow it, is called 1,000 Years of Annoying the French. So it's these differences of customs, of perception, priorities that lead to conflict, right? Well, no. Differences are normal. The picture of us as a church that St. Paul offers in 1 Corinthians 12 is that we, as a community, function like a single human body, but that we each have different roles, skills, ways of looking at things. As a body, we're not all supposed to be the eyes or the hands or the feet, otherwise we couldn't function properly. But as people, we don't like feeling isolated. We don't like feeling different from everybody else. So when we're in groups, organizations or communities, we tend to look for people who are like us or who see things like we do. Why do we do this? Well, we generally feel safer with people who are like us, who may have similar experiences or outlook. And this means by definition that our own group will have different ways of doing things from other groups. But if we're going to achieve anything at all, then we have to work together. When addressing the church, St. Paul wasn't asking the eyes, ears, or hands to ignore their differences and pretend they were all identical. He was telling them to be who they are with their own skills and experience, but to recognize and honor one another and work together. In a business, if everyone's in sales, what happens to the production and the quality of what you're trying to sell? And what happens to making sure there's enough money to pay the staff at the end of the month? And what happens about hiring the right people and keeping the IT system working? And in church, we have need people who have skills to focus on the youth, or on welcoming newcomers, or on worship, or teaching, or organizing corporate prayer, or leading a team, planning and organizing hospitality, and so on, and so on, and so on. We can and must have differences. And our ways of communicating can be different, even our priorities can be different, but we still are called to work as one. So James is saying then, what causes fights and quarrels among you? And he answers, finally the answer, it's the desires that battle within us. So it's not our differences that cause the problem, it's our desires that battle. So what does he mean by that? Well, in life we desire things, and when the desire is satisfied, we feel pleasure. In itself, that's fine. That's how we're made. If we're hungry or thirsty, and we eat or drink, we feel happy. If we've been working hard and we stop for a nice cup of tea, because we're English, then we feel happy again. If we want to get something right and we keep practicing, when we can do it, we feel good. These are natural desires which we can satisfy. But what happens when we have desires that we can't easily satisfy? James goes on to say, you desire, but you do not have, so you kill. You covet, but cannot get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. James is not saying that his listeners are all going around murdering one another, but he is saying that the consequence of pursuing pleasures at the center of our world leads to this. What do we do if we want something but someone else is standing in our way? When our primary aim becomes to satisfy our desires, we start by cutting corners. It's only a small corner I'm cutting, it'll be okay. Then the okay bit gets a bit bigger, and we start compromising on ethics, morality, or the law. If someone else is in the way of us achieving, satisfying our desires, we start to see them as the enemy, and we see ourselves as justified in removing them as an obstacle. Do you recognize this? Recorded in the Bible are several examples. You may know the story of King David and Bathsheba and her husband Uriah. So David's up on his rooftop one evening, looking out across the city, and he sees a beautiful woman having a bath, and he desires her, so he sends a letter and he invites her over. He cuts what he sees as a small corner in sleeping with her. Why is it only a small corner? Well, her husband Uriah is away in the army. He won't know. Possibly nobody will know. So no harm done, right? But then she gets pregnant. So, is Uriah going to know? Yep. So he recalls Uriah from the front line, and he tries to get him to sleep with his wife so that Uriah will think the baby is his. But because of his concern for his comrades at the front, Uriah won't sleep with Bathsheba. So he goes back to the army, and David arranges for Uriah to be killed in battle, which happens. And because of the way it's done, several other soldiers with Uriah also lose their lives. Don't know if you know the story of a guy called Naboth. He's a guy who had a very nice vineyard in Jezreel, right near the palace of King Ahab. And he had this lovely vineyard, and Ahab was looking out one day, and he saw this vineyard, and he thought, do you know, I really fancy a nice new vegetable garden. That would be brilliant. So he goes to Naboth, and he says, can I buy your vineyard from you? And Naboth says, well, I don't want to sell it, really, because it's my family inheritance, you know, and we've had it in the family for generations and so on. It's not for sale. And the king says, well, I'd really, really like it. Look, you know, I'll offer you loads of money, and I'll even offer you a better vineyard somewhere else if you let me have this one. And Naboth says, sorry, but I really don't want to sell it. So Ahab goes back and he sulks. And he's sulking in the palace. And the queen says to him, what's the matter with you? And he says, well, I've been down to see Naboth and he wouldn't sell me the vineyard and it's really nice and he can't see, you know, it's only land. Why can't he take a better one and so on? And the queen says, oh, don't be such a wimp. Sorry for the translation. Don't be such a wimp. Why don't you, or in fact, I'll do it, she says. I'll arrange for a big meeting. We'll have Naboth in the meeting, public gathering, and I'll arrange for two scoundrels, it's called, two bad guys, to say in front of everybody else that Naboth has slandered the king and slandered God, which is a capital offence. So they go to the meeting, these two guys stand up and say, Naboth has slandered God, slandered the king, and he's taken out and stoned. And Ahab says, great, thank you very much for the vineyard. And he does his new vegetable garden. In 2022, we're much more civilized than that, aren't we? We wouldn't have Naboth stoned. All we would need to do is to discredit him in front of his friends and colleagues. He loses his reputation, potentially his job. Yay. In social media, as you know, that's called trolling. And the consequences are that it's become almost a sport in many areas. And if you look at the impact of it on people's work, on their mental health, and on suicide rates, it's clearly an issue. There is something wrong with us, guys. Jesus says, you've heard it said, do not murder, and anyone who murders is subject to judgment, will be subject to judgment. But I tell you, Jesus says, that anyone who's angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Our attitudes make us just as guilty, even if we don't actually kill the person. So there is something fundamentally wrong with us. And unfortunately, James is writing to Christians. We're not exempt. In verse 4, James calls this friendship with the world. 2 weeks ago, Paul and Ben gave an excellent talk about this, where Paul talked about the world in this context, meaning the systems or structures around us that go against right behavior. Ben picked up on the friendship side and said that closeness, in other words, spending time with our friends, changes us and can change us and should change us. This means that friendship with the world changes us for the worse. Friendship with God changes us for the better. So it's important who our friends are and how much time we spend with them. The talk's still on the website, so if you want to pick up on that as a reminder or if you missed it. So looking at conflict then practically, when James talks about the cause of quarrels and conflict among us, it boils down basically to putting our own desires at the center rather than God's way. And again, that can seem like a fairly trivial thing, but if we go back to what I was saying earlier about the extent of just war, let alone any other kind of conflict, it's huge. Our desires in themselves are not wrong. It's what we do to satisfy them and the priority we place on it that causes the problem. And this friendship with the world, I think, can be broken down into four elements. The first one is a wrong understanding of ourselves, as though we were at the centre of the universe. Because I live in my head and everything else is out there, it's kind of not difficult to see myself as the centre of the universe. But actually, it's stuffed. Second thing, a wrong attitude towards things, meaning that we can be led into an unhealthy desire for what other people have and we don't, whether that's a vineyard or access to resources or money. The third thing is a broken fellowship with other people who become dispensable so that we can get our own way. And the fourth one is a broken relationship with God. There is something fundamentally wrong with people, with all of us, and this is why. But God isn't just sitting there doing nothing and letting us wallow. Jesus, who is God come to earth, lived in history and died in history and rose again in history so that our relationship with God can be restored. If we come before him and recognize who he is and who we are, he makes us clean again and gives us a new start. He sends his Holy Spirit to restore our relationships with other people. The Holy Spirit leads us into the truth so that we grow in understanding about the realities around us. And this same Holy Spirit produces in us power and love and self-discipline. James says that rather than putting ourselves at the center of the universe, putting God at the center changes everything, including how we pray and how God answers. So I'd just like to say this morning that if you recognize that there is a problem within you, me, all of us, whether it's a broken relationship between you and God, or between you and other people, or about how your life is, there'll be a prayer team at the front a little later on, so please come and we'll pray with you. So as we've seen in verse 1 of chapter 4, James issues quite a blunt and I would say confrontational challenge. What causes fights and quarrels among you? And says that this path leads to hating, killing, and becoming an enemy of God. But the two verses just before that that lead into his question, the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive to God, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Do you want to be like that? And then the final verse in that chapter 3, peacemakers who sow in peace raise a harvest of righteousness. In those two verses, James talks three times about peace. And he's obviously seeing the opposite of quarrels and conflict as peace. Peacemakers is who we're called to be. Peacemakers comes from having a healthy view of ourselves. In other words, we're not at the center of the universe. From a restored relationship with God, where he is at the center, and a healthy view of others. I honor and respect them, benefit from the differences we have, and serve them rather than getting them to serve my interests. St. Paul, could you put the Philippians up, please, Marie? St. Paul, writing to a local church community, let's say he's writing to us, he says, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if you do. So, question, church, do you have any encouragement from being united with Christ?
Yes.
Good. Do you have any comfort from his love?
Yes.
Do you have any fellowship with the Spirit?
Yes.
Do you have any tenderness and compassion?
Yes.
Hope so. He says, if so, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, us together, having the same love, being one in spirit and purpose. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider yourselves better than consider others better than yourselves. See how easy it is to do. Consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Now, this does not mean that I need to see myself as a wretched worm and everybody else's opinions are better than mine and my needs don't count. First, Paul is not saying don't look after your own interests. He's saying do look after your own interests, but don't keep them at the centre of everything. Look after other people's interests as well. Second, Paul goes on to tell us that these are the hallmarks of an effective servant like Christ Jesus, a little later in the same passage. Jesus didn't see himself, guys, as a wretched worm. He knew other people were often wrong or misguided. And when he was tired or in need of peace, he went off on his own. But he was committed to serving those around him and working for their best. And the third thing, we're called to be a community. Well, you might say, if I'm off serving everybody else all the time, what about me? Who's thinking about what I might need? Well, the answer is, if we get this right, I and each of us will have 60 or 70 other people looking out for us. Does that sound good? And honestly, in my humble opinion, 60 or 70 of you lot looking out for me is much better than me trying to look out for myself all the time. So if we can do that, that's where we're going. So James is calling us to be peacemakers. So what does Jesus say about peacemakers? Anybody remember? They're blessed. Yeah, blessed are the peacemakers because they will be called sons of God, sometimes translated children of God, meaning is heirs of God, that they inherit stuff from God. It's important to recognize here that Jesus and James aren't calling us to be peaceful, but to be peacemakers. So let's just unpack that a bit. What is peace? Normally, we think of peace as being the absence of something. When I was young, and my brother and I were playing normal games that boys play, you'd hear us shout, "Boys, give us some peace!" What did he mean? He meant, stop the noise. Shut up. Peace usually, to us, means no noise, no pressure. Peace means no war, right? We've had peace in this country for however many decades, haven't we? Well, we haven't had war, whether it's really been peaceful. But shalom, the Hebrew word for peace, at its root means completeness. So we have peace when we are completed. Getting peace isn't about taking things away. It's about adding what's missing. This might well include a restored relationship with God or a healthy view of ourselves and others. And James 3:18, could you just put up the beginning of the James thing, Marie? Thank you. James 3:18, the one that says, peacemakers who sow in peace reap a harvest of righteousness. Easy to gloss over that. In the Greek, James obviously wrote it in, literally it says, now the fruit of righteousness in peace is sown. Does that sound like Star Wars? The fruit of righteousness in peace is sown. is sown by those making peace. So it's not as if you've got a person called a peacemaker. It's people who go around doing stuff. This is an activity. It's not a description of somebody. It's an activity. So peacemakers means not just people who are living peacefully or keeping out of the way of conflict or avoiding trouble. Being a peacemaker is active. It's something we're called to do, to create peace where it's missing. The verb making here, people who are making peace, is a word, poiein, from where we get our words poem and poet. Anybody here who's tried writing poetry? Yay. Well, what's the matter with the rest of you? Well, those of you who have tried will know that it's hard, isn't it? If it's going to be any good, you've got to work at it, you've got to craft it, you've got to focus not only on the essence of the thing you want to communicate, but how you say it. A poet is a craftsman, starting with a blank page and creating something of beauty and power. A peacemaker is also a craftsman creating something of beauty and power, making peace, completeness, wholeness where there was none. How do we do that? Well, you'll be pleased to know that that involves another talk, which we won't have time for today. At a high level, if we're talking about, you know, Russia, Ukraine, for example, it might include skills in negotiation, arbitration, and so on. But for all of us, on a day-to-day basis, it certainly includes making real connections with people who are different from us. It includes talking to people who are in conflict to understand what's missing from their peace. It includes bringing peace into situations which are okay but not great. It includes taking time with someone who disagrees with me to understand why. We can't shrug and say, well, there's fundamentally wrong with that, something fundamentally wrong with that person because they can't see why I'm right and they're wrong. We need to be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. So it includes listening and understanding. If you want to construct a bridge across a river, you need to understand what both banks are like before you start building. And I think for a lot of us, we just think we need to get across and just start building from one side and wondering why the thing collapses in the middle. And it includes working at it and getting better. So we're going to have an opportunity for some prayer now. And I just want to emphasize, you know, this isn't sort of me saying to everybody, you blah, blah, blah. This is something which James is writing to all of us, and we're in it together. So if you recognize that there's a problem, whether it's a broken relationship between you and God or you and other people or about how your life is at the moment, please ask someone to pray for you, pray with you. If you recognize that there are areas where you may be able to be a peacemaker, but you're not sure how to do it and need wisdom, please ask someone to pray with you. Do you remember we had in a talk a few weeks ago, if any of you lack wisdom, ask God who gives generously. We're in this together.